Hi, it's The Takeaway for Wednesday, October 25th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, live from KERA in Dallas today, although we begin in Washington, D.C.
When the next generation asks us, why didn't you do something? Why didn't you speak up? What are we going to say? Mr. President, I rise today to say enough.
Enough, said a wavering Republican, Jeff Flake, from the Senate floor on Tuesday.
The personal attacks, the threats against principles, freedoms, and institution, the flagrant disregard for truth and decency, the reckless provocations, most often for the pettiest and most personal reasons, reasons having nothing whatsoever to do with the fortunes of the people that we have been elected to serve.
Though he never mentioned him by name, the Jeff Flake target was clear. President Donald Trump, the commander-in-chief and leader of Flake's own Republican Party. It was a stinging 17-minute speech, and with it, conservative Jeff Flake joined a tiny group of Republicans who started taking on President Trump.
Our politics seems more vulnerable to conspiracy theories and outright fabrication.
I don't know why he lowers himself to such a low, low standard and debases our country in the way that he does.
And all we've really done this year is confirm Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court.
Former President George W. Bush, Senator Bob Corker from Tennessee, and Senator John McCain there from Arizona. What do all these men have in common, aside from sounding the alarm about the former president? Well, they all have very little to lose. George W. Bush is former President George W. Bush. Bob Corker isn't running for re-election, neither is John McCain. And Jeff Flake was facing a tough, tough primary in Arizona after criticizing President Trump for more than a year. He's not running for re-election either. Still, Flake had another broad point to make, one that was largely lost as he stood in the Senate and fired his broadside at the president. Flake called out Republicans, leaders, people like Speaker Paul Ryan and Senator Mitch McConnell, again, not by name, but for tolerating and normalizing damage to the Republic in the service of political wins.
We must stop pretending that the degradation of our politics and the conduct of some in our executive branch are normal. They are not normal. Reckless, outrageous, and undignified behavior has become excused and countenanced as telling it like it is, when it is actually just reckless, outrageous, and undignified.
Flake said he can't win in today's Republican Party as a conservative who believes in small government and free trade. He warned against the growing tide of Trump isolationism. So what does this quartet of criticism mean? Will it grow? And what does it make plain that many Republicans have feared all along? Does it make it plain indeed that the populist opportunism embodied in Donald Trump is destroying the Republican Party? Joining me, Ryan Williams, Republican strategist and former spokesman for Mitt Romney's presidential campaigns, and also Kim Alfano, a Republican strategist as well and CEO of Alfano Communications. Ryan and Kim, thank you both for being here.
Good to be
with
you.
Thanks, Todd.
Kim, let me start with you, because I know that you watched this speech along with every Republican in Washington who cares about the state of their party. What did you see when Jeff Flake was on the floor?
Well, I saw a good man who is clearly in pain. I saw some irony in the fact that he did it from the Senate floor, which is he made an inherently political speech from the floor of the Senate, where he was saying that we should keep politics out and governance in. So I saw a tad of irony there, but you know, I saw a man struggling with the morality of the party, not necessarily the ideology of the party. I think our ideology is strong and we're united on that. I think that we're just plagued by living in a Snapchat nation where we can't seem to focus on anything long enough to get any kind of results. And we're dealing with a party or a segment of the country that can't deal with the lack of results anymore, and will take whatever and whomever they can get to get some sort of result. And what that brought us was Donald Trump, who promised some action, promised something different, but along with him came sort of a bombast and an external unpleasantness that we don't really love at the head of our party.
Ryan, your former boss, Mitt Romney, before the election, gave a speech that reminded a lot of people of what Jeff Flake had to say on the Senate floor.
Yeah, he gave a pretty stinging speech, I believe it was in Utah during the campaign, not just on
policy issues with Donald Trump, but who Donald Trump was as a person, the governor, talked kind of in depth about the unpleasantness that he brings to politics and his behavior and the thin-skinnedness and the way he's conducted himself over really his life.
Let me put it very plainly. If we Republicans choose Donald Trump as our nominee, the prospects for a safe and prosperous future are greatly diminished.
And I know that's frustrating to people like Jeff Flake as well, but Governor Romney, after giving that speech, as you recall, tried to give Donald Trump the benefit of the doubt. He met with him, had a discussion about serving in his administration after he was elected. I think people like Jeff Flake did that as well. After the election, they wanted to see him succeed. They wanted to see him govern and get results, and that just hasn't happened. And we're at a point now where the focus really is on the nasty day-to-day insults and slights and back and forths instead of getting results, which we should be getting with an all-Republican Congress and a Republican president. But that's not happening. And I think the results we're seeing now are people like Senator Corker and Senator Flake stepping back from public life and really a shift in the party in general.
I want to talk a little bit about sort of the two messages that Kim mentioned, the ideology of the party and then also the messenger and the leader of the party, these two different things, because there's a bargain at stake here. And one of the things that Jeff Flake talked about, and other Republicans have as well, although much more quietly, is the enabling that they see in the Republican Party. Listen to this one sort of veiled statement from Jeff Flake that I want to play you here.
Regret for the compromise of our moral authority. And by our, I mean all of our, complicity in this alarming and dangerous state of affairs. It is time for our complicity and our accommodation of the unacceptable to end.
Kim, there is a bargain that Republicans have made in order to get their policy preferences, tax cuts, Obamacare repeal, through the election of Donald Trump, who won their nomination. Jeff Flake is starting to suggest that there's complicity on the parts of people like Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan, and the rest of his party.
Well, I go back to what I said in the beginning, which is we all believe in very, very similar ideals. We, the quote unquote establishment, and the people who elected Donald Trump. I think that we want tax cuts. We want to reform health care. We want safer borders. We want a safer country. We want a strong military. These are the core principles that have abided the Republican Party forever. The problem is our messenger is a little bit nutty. But like I said before, I think we're a nation now who consumes information in such quick little bits and bites. I remember being frustrated with how people thought the 30-second ad was killing politics. Well, now I think the 5-second Snapchat or the 7-second Snapchat is killing our ability to get things done. What Donald Trump was successful in doing and why we, I think, attached to him as a party was he would throw that stick of dynamite. He would never light it, if you recall. He would say some outrageous things to capture the attention in this sort of cacophony of little bits and pieces of information. And it captured the attention of those folks that are so frustrated with nothing getting done. But he always would backpedal, and he would always come back to a more sane part of the ideology that we could agree with. So I think a lot of people like me in the party thought, well, crud, let P.T. Barnum go up there and put on his show. If we have control of everything, we can do the things that we've said we've wanted to do in a sane and rational way and let him, entertain the nation. The problem is we're not getting anything done. So both Donald Trump and our party live and die by results, and we're not getting any, and we haven't figured out how to get it with him or without him. And
one of the problems that Jeff Flake brought to the fore, which is what he calls complicity with the antics and style and morality of Donald Trump, isn't bringing any results and maybe bringing extreme damage as well. Ryan, a question for you. A lot of people responded to Jeff Flake's speech, since he's not running for re-election, and they said, if this is the dilemma in the Republican Party, you should have gotten in the primary, raised these exact issues, and see if people supported it. That's how you solve this. That's how you reach resolution on this.
That's one approach. I think that he probably would have lost the primary if he had done that, and would have been out of the Senate anyways. I think now he feels he's liberated to say what he wants and can speak out against the president. I think he thinks that's the best approach. That's something he could not have done if he was running a competitive Senate primary, which he was already having trouble with. I do think that his concerns go just beyond the lack of getting results. I think it's the behavior that he's talking about that's being normalized by not being called out by our leaders who are trying to work with the president. You know, it ranges from, you know, morally repulsive things like his attacks on the Gold Star families to dangerous things like his tweets about North Korea, at foreign leaders, things that really put the country at risk. And I think that's what he was talking about when he talked about normalizing this behavior by just letting it go without, you know, denouncing it as the leaders do on a day-to-day basis, because there are so many controversies. I think that's what he's referencing. But at the same time, Speaker Ryan and Leader McConnell want to get things done. They don't want to have to jump down the rabbit hole and condemn him on every controversy that he throws into the public sphere, which seems to be two or three on any given day. And that's the problem they find themselves in. So I understand both perspectives, and I think the party and leaders in general are just in a very difficult position given the way that Trump has acted as president. He's brought the circus behavior to the White House where the stakes are much, much higher than during the campaign.
Republicans everywhere now reckoning with their nominee and their president, President Donald Trump. Jeff Flake from the Senate floor yesterday with his stinging attack on the president. Ryan Williams, I want to thank you, Republican strategist, former spokesman for Mitt Romney, and Kim Alfano, strategist as well, CEO for Alfano Communications. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Todd.
Thank you.
Well, we're hearing from lots of you, getting your reactions on our Facebook page to Senator Jeff Flake's speech yesterday. Zach Young says, if you keep voting in lockstep with today's Republican Party, then it simply validates their behavior and strategy of using a demagogue like Donald Trump to win elections. Deborah Schaefer says, no points for Mr. Flake. If he was a real warrior, he'd be brave enough to run against his primary challenger, the one he's afraid of losing to, and voice those opinions. And Brett Tierney wrote, he's retiring because he knows he can't win the next election. And now he's just bitter. Tell us what you think about Jeff Flake or anything else you hear on the show on our Facebook page. And let's stay in Washington, in the Senate, in fact, for just one more moment. Because on Tuesday night, not long after Jeff Flake's speech, the Senate voted to nullify a new rule designed to protect consumers from financial institutions. The rule allowed Americans to join together and file class action lawsuits against big banks and other institutions for things like fraud, instead of being forced into private arbitration. Wall Street fought hard against this rule, as did President Trump. And last night, ultimately, Vice President Mike Pence cast the tie-breaking vote to erase it. Among the senators who voted to erase it, McCain, Corker, and Jeff Flake, all three anti-regulation Republicans. So those votes aren't too much of a shock, but it's just one example of how even when a party is in crisis, as Kim Alfano said, there's plenty of agreement behind the scenes. You're listening to The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More at Staples stores or staples.com/print and marketing. Staples, it's pro time. You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
There is a war being waged on our police officers.
There's an oppressive force in the way that criminal justice engages with black bodies.
And it becomes unrepairable. It doesn't take a lot for things to spiral out of control.
Put their minds somewhat at ease when they're out here on the streets and not be so aggressive, because they're supposed to protect and serve, not kill us all.
They want to invite for coffee and dinner people who tweet out support of convicted cop killers.
Most of you guys don't know what it's like to be followed in the store for no reason, to be stopped and pulled over for no reason.
It's simply not going to end.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, broadcasting today from the studios of KERA in Dallas, Texas. In our new series, To Serve and Protect, Life Behind the Blue Line, we're hearing from police officers from all around the country about the state of policing today during this highly politicized and emotionally charged time. Since the sniper attacks in July of 2016, which left five Dallas cops dead and nine wounded, a new class of officers has graduated from the police academy here. These young officers are currently field training with veteran cops. Today, we hear from one recent recruit who shares his perspective from the other side of that blue line.
My name is Justin Milton. I'm a police officer for the Dallas Police Department, 23 years old. I started the academy September 21st, graduated June the 2nd, and now I'm in field training right now. I was born and raised in Mississippi. I went to the greatest HBCU, Alcorn State University, and I studied criminal justice. Right now I'm on, it's called First Watch, 12 a.m. to 8 a.m. I work in the South Dallas area. I'm with a trainer, so wherever he goes, I go. Being able to see a senior officer is a pretty cool experience, how he handles situations. You learn everything you need to learn in the academy, but it's different trying to apply it in the streets. There'll be things I just won't know that a field trainer will be able to help me with, and it'll help me become a better officer. You know, sometimes when you turn on the TV, it just seems like there's negativity when it comes to this profession.
Good evening from New York. I'm Chris Hayes. For the second time in 2 days, a police killing of a black man has brought about outrage.
In Texas, there was the shooting death of 15-year-old Jordan Edwards last week.
There is new video of a fatal police shooting in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Minneapolis Police Chief Janae Hartaux-Anthony started with a very strong statement saying Justine did not have to die.
But when you're out there and you see how people react to you handling a call, they'll thank you, and I was very surprised. I had my mind set when I got here. It was going to be tough. I just felt like people would maybe not appreciate the work that I'm doing, but like I said, it was a total surprise when I saw how many people actually appreciated what you do. I've learned it's good to be able to not necessarily sympathize, but empathize, to try to be able to help understand their situation, and in turn, they help understand why you do, why you're taking the action that you're taking. Being on the street, you try to gain a rapport with a person, trying to so they can feel comfortable enough to tell you the situation that's going on or how would they like things handled. The color of my skin, you know, there are instances where there are some people who will talk to me before they talk to my trainer. I feel like maybe that's just some people's way of, you know, we are the same. I would like to talk to you to see maybe if you could understand better my situation, you know, because we're from the same culture and race, and that's fine. If that what makes somebody comfortable enough to be able to articulate what their issue is, I have no issues with it. You know, just like I said, building rapport. If they're comfortable enough to talk to me, then I let them. If they're more comfortable talking to my partner, my trainer, then that is fine as well. I'll find another way to try to be helpful in the situation. In order to ease the feelings between groups on each side, I truly feel like I said, it's just communication, open dialogue, being able to articulate each other's points and being able to listen. Nothing can be accomplished if you're not willing to listen and actually sit down and have a dialogue between each side. We've come a long way, but, you know, we can always be better. I mean, I just feel like that's so key when it comes down to being able to hash out whatever needs to be hashed out. I understand that there are things that people don't like, don't understand. I totally understand that. And I just feel like protests are cool, but you have to put in the work. And, you know, I would truly say, like, just getting everybody together and just trying to have a dialogue, trying to hash it out, trying to see where as officers we can be better, trying to have citizens see where they can do things differently, where we all can do things in a different light that'll get us to a point where there's not that tension. And I know I'm, you know, talking about something that might never happen, but if we can at least start the conversation, I think that's a good place to start at, and that's a good way to go.
Officer Justin Milton from the Dallas Police Department speaking to us. And we've been hearing from you as well. What's your take on policing right now?
I'm law enforcement. I became law enforcement after losing a family member in the towers during September 11th. Some of the most honest people that I've met most solid people that I would trust my life with are the people that I work with. What I feel that the public is missing is that to truly understand how law enforcement thinks and feels and approaches situations, you can only truly understand that if you put your feet in those shoes.
Judith Ackerman, New York City. I don't understand why you're carrying on and on about how great the police are and how kind and wonderful and individualistic each police officer is. The whole police system has to be overhauled, and anyone who wants to be a police officer should have a master's degree in social work.
Mark from Philadelphia. When it comes to the police forces of this nation, although I may not agree with everything that some of them have done, the police are the institution that provides the sense of the rule of law that we rely on in this nation. God bless the good police officers of the United States of America.
Your voices as we look at the lives of police officers and their families. Keep giving us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is supported by Westridge Dual Diagnosis Treatment Centers, aspiring to help men with co-occurring mental illness and substance use disorders with a family-centered integrated treatment approach. More at westbridge.org.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Let's imagine the future for just a minute. We've elected our first AI president, and Google has just bought the naming rights to the moon. How are you going to buy tickets to get there for the weekend? Now, I don't mean how are you going to afford it. I mean, literally, how are you going to buy those tickets? With dollars? With Earthcoin? Some yet-to-be-invented virtual currency? Well, a new documentary called The Future of Money explores what buying stuff could look like in the real world. And it might not be what you think. It's all part of a new documentary series called What Happens Next from our friends at Retro Report and Quartz. David Birch is author of the new book, Before Babylon, Beyond Bitcoin, and he says the future of money is that it'll be closely tied to the values of the people spending it.
I think the idea that we belong to one community and therefore we have one kind of money that serves that community, that's not really where we're headed. So you could imagine, why does California have the same money as West Virginia? They have completely different economies, completely different economic circumstances. You might want to have one set of interest rates in one place and one in another. And then you begin to think about the other kinds of communities people feel they belong to. You know, you could imagine, and I've heard other people talk about this, a global electronic Islamic e-dinar that's not an interest-bearing currency. And, you know, there's lots of reasons why billions of people might want to use that, and so on and so forth. So the technology allows incredible experimentation. People will experiment, and they will create lots of different kinds of money.
One of the points that this documentary that you appeared in Retro Report on the future of money is how they go to Yap Island in the South Pacific, home of now these famous huge stone coins, which weren't traded like coins in your pocket. That would never work. But really operated on the idea that everyone in the village knew the story of the coin, everyone in the village knew why the coin belonged to you and not to me, and they found out if you gave it to me and why. How are those things similar?
I mean, in that sense, money is a primitive form of memory. But the reason why I think the future is going to be different, and the reason why I'm thinking about the community side of things, is those are dumb kinds of money. Right? The rock. The rock doesn't remember where it's been. You have to remember where the rock's been. The rock doesn't remember. Dollar bills don't know where they've been. They don't know who they belong to. They don't know what they were doing. But when you start talking about things like bitcoins and cryptocurrencies, these things are software. And you can think of them as an interesting new form of computer. You can turn dumb money into smart money because it can run software. So you can have interesting new versions of money that carry with them their communities' goals, desires, values, and so on and so forth.
There's a concept that drives these cryptocurrencies called the blockchain. What is the blockchain and how does it help define the new concept of money that you're talking about?
if I have something that's just bits on my computer and I give you a copy of it, right, like a photo, I have a photo of me and I send you the photo. Now we both have copies of the photo. And that's fine when it's a photo, but actually it's not so good when it's money or concert tickets or, you know, the deeds to some property or whatever. So what you want is a system that means you can't just give the same bits to person after person after person after person. And so what the blockchain does through some very clever and very innovative use of cryptography, when I give my concert tickets to you, we tell everyone in the system that I gave those tickets to you, and then the system does these computations, which mean that somebody else can't come in and then just take a copy of the tickets themselves. We have a collective memory, and that collective memory remembers who has what bits. In terms of economic efficiency, it's not obvious that the blockchain is the best way of doing things. But it's attractive to some people because it doesn't require you to trust, you know, the government or some other third party to do this for you. I'm not absolutely convinced that Bitcoin is the final leaf on the evolutionary tree.
Dave Birch is author of the new book, Before Babylon, Beyond Bitcoin. Dave, thanks so much.
You're more than welcome. Thanks for having me.
What will our world look like in 50 years? You can ask people like economists or computer scientists, but we wanted to have just a little more fun. So for our ongoing series about the year 2067, we asked science fiction writers to tell us what they think will happen in this future. Paolo Bacigalupi is author of The Wind-Up Girl and other novels and short stories. He thinks about the future by zeroing in on trends and imagining what would happen if we continue down that path. Today, Bacigalupi sees a society paying less and less attention to science and worries that by 2067, we might completely ignore it.
I can very easily imagine a future 50 years out where our air and water quality are worse, where we're ignorant of why our climate is changing and how it's changing. And so you could easily imagine ourselves sort of up to our necks in seawater and calling it high tide. And without a vocabulary to even talk about what sea level rise is and why it's happening, without a vocabulary to talk about why cities are being swamped, because we aren't willing to talk about the fact that our world is changing. I could very easily see places like Lake Erie poisoned completely by toxic algae because we aren't monitoring whether or not all the farm water runoff is going into the lakes and what's in it. I could imagine human health effects. I could imagine us being sicker. You know, the question of like, what kind of water quality do we have in our pipes is, you know, something that shows up in Flint, Michigan, but you can sort of extrapolate that out to our entire world. If we don't have agencies that even look at our water quality, what kind of water is coming in, what kind of water is coming out, and what we're drinking or bathing in. One of the things that's really fascinating to me is when you look at things like hermaphrodism in fish downstream from water treatment plants, where you're seeing all sorts of extra chemicals changing the way that fish are developing, you have to sort of pause and say, shouldn't we study this more? If we don't study it more, you could sort of imagine a future where we're also semi-hermaphroditic, where our biological systems are so messed up by endocrine disruptors that we aren't really functioning anymore in the same way as we used to. You could imagine an even sort of dumber version of ourselves. All of us sort of grappling with the idea that, you know, oh, gee, we're being swamped by climate change, our cities are being flooded, whatever, and we also don't really have the adaptive response even to organize decent rescue operations because we're all, as a society, as we increasingly become distracted and broken as sort of intellectual people, we lose our organizing abilities as a society. So 50 years in the future, we're less organized, we're dumber, we're more violent. You could do a lot of those things just from the basic idea that we stopped trying to keep our human environment clean, that we stopped looking at what kinds of factors were feeding into our dysfunctions, that we stopped looking at whether or not like our world was changing and whether or not that was dangerous for us. You end up with a world and a society which is impoverished. you end up in a space where even the wealthy don't rest as easy as they might, because the poor, the hungry, the displaced, all are on the move and trying to find resources when there is no safe place for them anymore. Once you get rid of science, the thing that's interesting is that you have this opportunity to sort of fill it with other stories. You can start building other theories, and essentially what you're talking about is magical thinking then. And so if we don't have a reason, you know, a scientific reason to understand why our sea level's rising, you can create other reasons, and that's God is angry, or we were sinners, or you can create any number of stories. Why do I have boils developing on my body every time I go in the water? Well, gee, that's just because you weren't a pure person. Without somebody standing there and saying, wait, we tested this, we looked at it, we evaluated it, and we did it in an organized way, then otherwise you just have the magical thinking of people creating any story that they want.
Paolo Bacigalupi is author of The Wind-Up Girl and other novels and short stories. You can check out our full series about 50 years from now at thetakeaway.org/2067. Thanks for joining us on The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, coming to you from KERA in Dallas, Texas today. We just heard how author Paolo Bacigalupi imagines a future where we ignore science to disastrous consequences. But for many parts of the world, we might already be there. A new study has just looked at the burden we're putting on ourselves with pollution, and the results are shocking. Listen to this. One out of every six premature deaths around the world, some 9 million in all every year, is caused by pollution. And the study's authors have called that a conservative estimate. Neil Basu is the Canada Research Chair in Environmental Health and Sciences at McGill University. He's a toxicologist, and he was a co-author on this study. When I spoke to him today, he explained the gravity of what he found.
In places where pollution is most affecting people, so these low and middle-income countries, unfortunately, right now, it's the perfect storm. So the environment is not clean. There's rapid development. There's a lot of pollution being spewed into the air and the water. Oftentimes, people live very, very close to these centers of pollution. In most of these countries, there aren't legitimate or useful regulations that help curb pollution. So it's really the perfect storm right now.
It's a perfect storm, and we see pictures of cities in China that have fog conditions on a regular basis. It's not fog, it's smog, it's gray air, the pollution that you can really see.
Yeah, and it's horrendous. And for much of the world that's being affected by this, pollution is visible day in and day out. And this is something we take for granted. But, you know, here in this country, if we look back just 50 years ago, it's not that long ago, we step outside and the air could be choking. That there were days in which there was so much fog that was essentially toxic smoke out there that people wouldn't want to leave their homes. There were cases from about 50 years ago here when our rivers were catching on fire. So there was a time not that long ago here in North America where pollution was part of our everyday lives, just visible on the landscape and scarring it.
So that was in America's past, really. That was in the past of the West. But there seems to be an acceptance here that this is the price of progress. Many of these countries, China, India, they're industrializing. If a certain portion of the poor go by the wayside in the meantime, that's called progress.
It doesn't have to be like that. And what our report also uncovered is that there can be tremendous co-benefits for cleaning the environment up, yet at the same time, those can have tremendous benefits towards health, towards the economy. If you think about the initiatives taken here in the 1970s to clean up the air and the water, what they eventually did is they resulted in tremendous economic prosperity to the nation in terms of workers being healthier so they can perform better at work, or healthcare costs going down. If you think of the example of the country, in many countries worldwide, getting rid of lead in gasoline, this has had a tremendous impact on the population. Lead is a proven developmental neurotoxicant. It reduces IQs, and what we've been able to do is to show through careful research that the removal of lead from gasoline has had tremendous impacts on a number of populations around the world. So there are great examples, and a number of examples that we highlight in the report to show that pollution prevention steps are feasible, that they are part of the solution, and that they can be win-win for the environment, for health, and for the economy.
Well, let's talk about some of these less developed countries, though, that do want to industrialize, that need to industrialize, that have awful pollution. Are any of them responding? Are any of these countries taking pollution seriously and trying to clean up?
I think many of them are. So a lot of my work is in West Africa, and every time I'm there, I'm meeting with people in the government, those that make decisions, researchers on the front lines, and they take this very seriously. So pollution is something that's part of their everyday lives, and many people in these countries are taking great steps and trying to improve the situation on the ground. Though with that being said, they do need help from the rest of the world. So pollution is a global issue. Pollution from one part of the world can, you know, it affects people locally, but it can also travel worldwide and have tremendous impacts on other populations worldwide. And it's important for us as a global community to band together and take a global approach to this.
Let's talk about the United States for just a moment. You did mention that a couple of generations ago was really the low point. Factories spewing out pollution, American cities were full of soot, walking outside made you choke on the air. But what is the state of pollution now here in the United States, even though maybe we don't see it as much as we used to?
Yeah, so let's not be fooled. I mean, pollution is still there. It's just a little bit more invisible now. If you look at our food system, if you look at our air, our water, many of our consumer goods, they're all loaded with chemicals. We live in a chemical society. It's these chemicals that we depend upon for advancements that we have in our society, but it's also these chemicals that are concern of us. Many of these chemicals are proven toxicant chemicals that they've been shown to erode our intelligence or impair our reproductive systems. Many of these chemicals have been shown to weaken our immune systems or enable cancers to spread. There's a really large evidence base on chemicals, and for many of these chemicals, we are quite concerned.
So, Neil, the economic costs here are staggering, and your study quotes a number, I think, of $4.5 trillion in lost economy and lost productivity. It's just an enormous cost. It suggests that as countries industrialize, it suggests that we as humans have really discounted the enormous cost of all this pollution and what it costs to care for people and what it costs us as a species.
Definitely. Again, this is one of the outcomes of the report that just boggled many of us writing the report, that pollution is costly. We've known this for a long, long time. It holds people and nations back from meeting their potential. We just couldn't fathom the numbers that we came up with, ordering in the trillions of dollars, percentages of GDPs for many, many countries, that this should make politicians and decision makers wake up, that this is really an issue not only about human health and human rights, but also of the economy, that if we're going to continue to pollute our planet, we're also going to be hindering progress and hindering economic development, and we're not going to be meeting our potential.
Is that the bottom line of your message here? I mean, I'm tempted to ask you how we turn this around, but I know you don't have a prescription for planet Earth. It seems like you've done a ledger here. These are the costs.
We have, though. With that being said, we also spend a lot of time in the report talking about the solutions. We want to make it very clear that, one, that pollution is a really big problem around the world. There are a number of cases that we're able to document showing the enormity of the problem. But on the other hand, that there are solutions, and these solutions come with co-benefits for the environment, the health, but also the economy. And when you look at the report, the solutions range from making pollution a really big priority at the local, the national, the international scale. It needs to be integrated into the way that we plan our cities, the way that we organize our countries, and eventually the world.
Neil Basu, McGill University, and one of the co-authors of this study looking at the human cost, the global cost of pollution on planet Earth. Neil Basu, thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you from KERA in Dallas today. We bring you now back to New York for a moment, to the ballet. You're sitting in a grand performance hall. Dancers are moving across the stage to the music of Philip Glass. It's a beautiful spectacle of movement. The curtain goes down on the first act. The lights go up for intermission, and you walk out into the lobby with the rest of the crowd. And there, suddenly, more dancers appear, leaping and twirling among the crowd. Pirouettes at the concession stands, pas de chat near the bathroom line.
The dancers are dressed in street clothes, and they're on par with the audience. It also does change this idea of ballet as behind this red curtain.
That's the French-born dancer-turned-choreographer Benjamin Millepied describing one of his new pieces. He's been trying to bring ballet out from behind that red curtain for years. His latest work premieres tonight on stage and off stage at the American Ballet Theater in New York City. Now, even if you don't know his name, you might recognize Millepied. He choreographed the 2010 thriller Black Swan, and he's become a major voice in the arts world with a mission to modernize ballet, including with his own contemporary company, the LA Dance Project. Takeaway producer Alexandra Boti sat down with Millepied at our New York City studios.
We live through a lot of, you know, life is full of emotions and experiences, and I, you know, my ballets are a way for me to make these tangible, you know, in an art form that's ephemeral, fleeting in some way. That's for me, like making these dances is a way for me to stay sane to some extent. And this piece is clearly influenced by a particular moment in time, which is now, which I've found, you know, for the first time, this idea that, you know, the world doesn't feel completely, you know, safe necessarily, or there's a sentiment of uncertainty that I choreographed a piece two years ago. It was right after I was working in Paris and premiered a piece in London. So I started to have this feeling. I lived in Paris at the darkest moment, and I think the end of the piece sort of reflected this feeling. And so now, you know, this new work called "I Feel the Earth Move," which I picked long before even some of the recent, you know, environmental issues were going on, definitely has a kind of, it's sort of an allegory for this moment in time with just symbols. It's not, I prefer to keep things in my imagination and create situations that people will read in different ways. But it certainly is a work that I imagine and created that is a reflection of the hope that I, you know, that I, That I believe in, you know, as a father, as a two children, like what if this all of these years that I've, you know, that I've lived through were really just very lucky in this moment where I, you know, we didn't have this feeling of, you know, who knows what the next 10 years will be like, you know, whether it's the environment or whether it's political, it's things are uncertain right now.
That's interesting that you began when you choreographed this thinking about the uncertainty in Europe. And then it carried over.
Well, you know, I mean, I was, so during all the worst terror attacks, I was working in Paris. And I resigned from the position there, started this piece, and it literally opened on the day of Brexit in London. And the whole ending of it is the sense of community and the sense of uncertainty in the last movement, which bewildered people. You know, they didn't know. You know, it's funny with ballet, you look at contemporary art and people have so many ways of approaching their work. You know, from my perspective, and I think for me, it's very much an emotional journey, and you know, creating these pieces isn't just an idea that's far away from actually what I live and what I feel, and you know, it's a way for me to understand myself better.
How can we be communicating that to people who don't think that ballet is for them?
You know, Stravinsky always said, I write my music for, you know, children and dogs, you know, and they understand it best. You know, the idea of having just no sort of preconceived notions is the best way, I think, to read and understand and experience art. In that sense, ballet is a very approachable art form, especially the fact that it's so connected to music. It's just that the dance, you know, ballet is performed in institutions and theaters that, for the most part, were made in the 1950s, at least here in America. So, you know, these are kind of temples of the arts that some people just aren't comfortable going into. It's not how they experience the world. They want to experience the world today or an evening out. You have to adapt and you have to recreate the experience, you know, how to experience art. You have to think about how to bring some meaningful experiences and, you know, like that to people. And that maybe is by going outside the theater and or creating new venues. But ultimately, it's not about going in the direction of superficiality.
So I want to ask you about when you did go back to your native France. And you took over as head at the Paris Opera Ballet. And I want to know what you expected that experience would be and then what you found it actually was.
In a way, I felt that what was most important about that theater was changing the direction of ballet that it had had pretty much for the last, 150 years. Because ballet had evolved and progressed in other places but Paris. What happened is that the turn to actually change ballet there, it was too sharp a change that I wanted to bring for that company. The idea of having a diverse company, frankly, there was a very old-fashioned, even while I was there with a socialist government, and when I came, I said, one of the first things I said was like, well, I can't run a company of 150 white dancers. And the response was, that's what gives the company its strength. So there was very much, even within a completely leftist kind of government and, people that I was working with, this idea that this company needs to be white because that's why it's so great, because the homogeneity and the, so that's, wow, you get there in 2016 and that's what these people are telling you. So, that was a fight that actually I wasn't going to win because there's, very, very complex rules. And so, we were just on different planes. In the end, it just wasn't for me. I felt very American and decided to keep my energy and come back to America and build the future, of dance as I see it here.
Now there's also a growing conversation around diversity in terms of choreographers, especially when it comes to women. It seems like the ballet world, in the U.S. in particular, is talking about why are there not more women at the helm of companies and making high-end great work for the big companies. Is that something that you see? Is that something you're addressing in your own company?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, first of all, it's specific to ballet. There are amazing women choreographer in contemporary dance. Some of my favorites. I mean, Pina Bausch, Twyla Tharp. I mean, there's so many great women choreographers. In a modern dance, unfortunately, because ballet should be the same, has had a more intellectual approach to art. The problem with ballet, as I see it, is that, the ballet schools only teach ballet. That is something completely crazy. The idea is that the only purpose of these ballet schools is to teach people how to dance well. There might be more men, but it doesn't mean there's more good work. I think it's just, if ballet schools made that more part of their mission, I think more women would be choreographing, more women would be interested, and more men, and we would see more good work and a better level of work. You don't become a composer by just being a musician. You study composition. You don't become, ballet is the only art form where suddenly someone that, wants to become a ballet choreographer, and they're, and they've got to figure it out on their own. And some do, and some do very well, but
just trained as a dancer.
Yeah, trained as a dancer doesn't do it, mm-hmm.
Okay, but I have to say there are some loud voices in the ballet community who are not really pushing the discussion in the same way. You might have seen that choreographer Alexei Ratmansky. He's artist in residence with American Ballet Theater. He wrote about this very thing on Facebook earlier this month. I'm going to read to you what he wrote. "Sorry, there is no such thing as equality in ballet. Women dance on point. Men lift and support women. Women receive flowers. Men escort women off stage, not the other way around." And he says, "I know there are a couple of exceptions, and I am very comfortable with that," he writes. What's your reaction to that?
Well, that's Alex's view. I don't agree with that view. I think it's diminishing and unfortunate, But what I will say is that's Alex's way. What we see by this push of, which is important. I mean, I think people need to be represented, but the choreographers who need to do it are the ones who actually, have something to say about it and relate about it. You're not every filmmaker isn't going to make a movie about you know, the Latino community or, you know, homosexuality. You know, everybody has different things to say, and they should create things that they relate to, you know, and that's what's important. And in that way, I think, you know, that's you know, appropriate that Alexei doesn't follow kind of a fashion to some extent.
Benjamin Munpia, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Takeaway producer Alexandra Boti speaking with choreographer Benjamin Millepied. You can find more of their conversation on our website at thetakeaway.org. Millepied's latest work premieres tonight at the American Ballet Theater in New York. And before we let you go today, we want to bring you up to date on a story that we've been following. We've been covering the story of the pregnant 17-year-old girl in immigration detention in Texas and the court battle over whether the federal government holding her must facilitate an abortion that she's requested. Well, the ACLU announced today that Jane Doe, as she's been known in court, has received that abortion. Federal lawyers had argued that the government could not stop Jane Doe from getting an abortion, but they refused to give her transportation or to temporarily release her from custody, and that meant no access to the procedure. Then a full panel of judges on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled yesterday that the government must allow Jane Doe to have the procedure. The ACLU did not announce who helped her to the abortion clinic. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. We're at KERA in Dallas tomorrow for one more day. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.